Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What's up, Fungal Associates? Welcome to Completely Arbitrary, the podcast about trees and other related topics. I am one of your hosts. My name is Alex Croson.
Hello, I'm Casey Clapp, also a host here today. I know you're expecting someone else. There's generally Casey's here. I'm going to fill in today.
You're Casey 2.
I'm Casey 2. I am Robot Casey.
Have you ever seen the movie Multiplicity, I think it's called?
I have not.
With that guy, Beetlejuice, who played Beetlejuice.
Ooh, I know who you're talking about. Yeah, he's the famous guy who's in the drum one.
Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton, the famous.
Yeah. He seems like, I don't know if he's been canceled, but he's a great actor.
I don't think he has been.
Multiplicity.
Yeah, okay.
He gets kind of drafted for this scientific program that clones you.
Yeah.
Because he is like a typical 90s TV dad. Yeah. He hates his wife and he just wants some time alone.
I see. So he clones himself.
But he's very busy at work too, Casey.
Oh.
So you're going to need two clones.
Yeah.
He ends up with like four or five and they all have different sort of defects because it's like inbreeding.
Hey, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. You know, speaking of being canceled, there's a show. You know the Mike or Morty, Jim and Morty, Frank and Morty,
Rick and Morty,
Richard and Morty. They, the guy who invented that show, I think he does the voice of the titular Morty.
Yeah, that's Justin Roiland
made a show way back when.
Yes,
called The Cosbys.
Yes,
or House of Cosbys.
I've seen this.
Yeah, they had the same thing where he would clone a Cosby, but it would come out with some different weird attribute, and then every 10th Cosby he cloned, it was a super Cosby. It was like data analysis. Cosby's the first one. It was like, we must solve the world. They made like five episodes, and then the last one, they had a cease and desist from the Cosbys.
Wow.
And then they just made like a really scribbly thing to like close out the story and be like, fuck Bill Cosby.
That's so funny.
It was hilarious. I think that was a late college thing. That was definitely canceled in every regard, except for Justin. He wasn't canceled. He did a good job.
Yeah, he went on to do very popular things with Dan Harmon, the creator of Community.
Yeah.
They co-created Rick and Morty.
Good for them, honestly. I love his voice. I think his voice is really funny.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Casey, speaking of co-creating, let's co-create an episode of Completely Arbitrary now. This week, as we do every week, we're talking about a tree. And this tree is pretty special.
It is. This is a fun one.
It's this is the this is the Andean paper tree.
Yes.
Casey, let's imagine that you and I.
All right.
We have our oxygen masks and we are hiking the hills of the Andes.
The mountains of the Andes, Alex.
I call them mega hills.
Yeah, it's a good term.
And we come across some Andean paper trees. We feel very blessed and grateful because they're so rare and high up.
Yeah.
And Casey, let's ID this tree.
All right, Alex, what we're going to do is cover a species, but there's about 20 different species and they're all in the genus Polylepis. And this is Polylepis racemosa is the one we're going to do today.
Racemosa.
Yes. Now racemosa means that its flowers are in a raceme. generally speaking, that's what that's referring to.
Okay.
A raceme being a kind of long central stem with flowers coming off of it, kind of alternating or rotating around.
Oh, yeah. This is similar maybe to a catkin, but different?
Yeah, exactly. Catkins, they're really tightly packed and very, very small. And usually the flowers are so reduced where they just are kind of like the bare minimum, you know? It's like they have that one part that does that one thing. Everything else is forgotten. A raceme, the flowers would still be almost full, big flowers with sepals and petals and all the different parts inside. And this is a hermaphroditic flower, so it has both parts inside of it. So it's essentially a perfect flower.
Like a magnolia.
Precisely, Alex.
Casey, I have a bit of an on-topic/off-topic question.
All right, let's start with the off-topic portion.
Here we go. So flowers
that
grow on trees, can you breed like a garden flower out of a flower that grows on a tree? Like if I were to take a jacaranda flower and like can I propagate that in my garden and make like a jacaranda shrub?
Not really. You would be you could take it and you could make it into another thing. You could grow it, graft it onto something or just stick it in like root hormone and then have it grow new roots.
Yeah.
That would work, but it would just become a new tree.
Okay.
It would, you could keep it as a shrub, but you could also, there are sometimes you can get species varieties that you can, that are very small for whatever reason, or they're dwarf or they just don't get very big for whatever, whatever thing. So you could do that and you could breed it into this, you know, find the genes and like just select for the ones that are really small. But it sounds like what you're talking about is like almost evolved from a tree to a shrub or an herb of some sort.
Yeah, like a rose bush. Yeah. But like imagine if roses naturally grew on a rose tree.
Yeah, I don't think so without changing like chromosomes and genes in a pretty intense way.
Well, I am looking for a new hobby.
Hey, honestly, try it out. Let's see what you get to.
Genetic manipulation.
That'd be amazing.
What's that? What's that? What's that science called?
Genealogy.
Genealogy.
No, I'm sorry. I was hoping you were going to know that genealogy is not that.
It's humans.
Yes, it is. It's like just your ancestors.
Yeah.
What is it? I guess it's just genetics in a larger sense.
Botanical genetics.
Yeah, or bioengineering in a way where you're doing that kind of thing.
Okay.
Anyway.
Hey, bioengineering, speaking of multiplicity.
Yeah. Oh, yes, it's exactly what it is. This is a multiplicitorous episode. Multiplitorous.
Either pronunciation is fine.
It's exactly like, it's like fungi and fungi.
Yeah, it's like fungi and fungi. Casey, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Let's continue talking about the Andean paper tree.
Okay, so the Andean paper tree, the one that we're talking about, it actually has an indigenous name, and it is Kiwinya.
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 Wonderful.
Q-U-E-U-N with a little tilde over the top of it.
I'm going to look this up.
A. Sounds good. But it's pronounced Q-I-W-I-N-A with a little tilde over the top of the N, so it has a nya.
How do you spell this again?
You're looking for Q-U-E-U-N with a tilde A. Q-U-E-U-N with a tilde A.
Kiwinya.
Kiwinya, no. Kiwinya? No, I think it's pronounced Kiwinya.
There's no E between the U and the N.
E-U-N. All right, that's fair. Well, the notes that I found actually have it spelled Q-I-W-I-N with the tilde A, and that is how they pronounce it in the native language of Quechua.
All right. Well, I guess I don't speak that language. I just speak Spanish.
That's very fair. I don't speak Spanish, so I saw the pronunciation in the native language, so I assume that it was just a Spanish spelling of the native pronunciation.
I see.
So that's where I got my cues from.
I also don't speak Spanish really.
Well, either way, that's the name of the tree.
Kiwinya.
In either the Spanish or the native Quechua, or in the Latin Polylepis racemosa. There also is the Spanish, because they call it the Andean paper tree. All these different species, again, there's 20 different species. Yeah. They would call it the Arbor del Papel.
Ooh.
So that's the tree of paper.
Sure.
Which is kind of fun.
Well, are we getting into the paper aspect of this tree? Is it the bark?
Nah, it is the bark. So that it has like red bark, and it peels off, kind of similar to the madrone. But while it peels, the big difference is that the madrone, it would kind of peel off and kind of go away mm-hmm. after time. This, the peels kind of stay on top of each other, so it looks like a really Ooh. Big, like kind of fluffed. Peely bark where
That's
it looks
great.
Really, really kind of big and extremely fancy looking.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really gorgeous, and the wood is very, very strong and kind of sinewy, so it has this like hard look to it, you know? It looks like muscles.
Wow.
It's really super stupendously gorgeous. And it grows at the highest elevations. Like, I mean, just beyond imagination high. And this is kind of the thing that always makes me kind of like kind of really like take a second, be like, wait a second, how high? And everything is in meters, so I had to do a lot of calculations. The highest recorded one that I have found so far is one of our species, I believe, the Quinia, the Polyepis racemosa, which is at 16,076 feet.
Say that again, 16,000?
1,000. A mile is like 5,250 or something Whoa. Like that. I don't, it's a little bit more.
Yeah.
But suffice it to say, every 5,000 feet is essentially nearly a mile.
This thing's 3 miles high.
It's 3 miles high. Or wow. maybe just this side of 3 miles high.
That's incredible.
That is what makes this tree like really kind of unique and special. And its leaves are very, very short. They're actually, I would call them tripinnate, where they come out and then their petiole splits at the leaf blade into three different leaflets.
Ooh, it's one like terminal. A three-needle pine.
Yeah,
but
kind
with
of.
Broad leaves.
Yeah, and they just come out and they just go one left, one to the right, one straight out.
Wow.
And they're crenate, so they have a really beautiful kind of small little circles or half circles all around the edge of them.
Aww.
So they look very scalloped is another good descriptor, I think.
That's their margin is yeah. little scalloped edges.
Exactly.
They're also, would you also call these lanceolate?
Yes, the leaflets are lanceolate.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the little leaves are really dark green. They're alternately arranged along the twig, but they're usually kind of pushed out at the end. So it's hard to tell their alternations, but they're in the rose family, so they're kind of a weird rose family relative. Most things in the rose family, like cherries and plums, cotoneasters, the rose itself, mm-hmm. millions and millions of other plants, individuals, probably thousands or hundreds of other families or genre.
Sure.
Not families, just genre. They are usually pollinated by insects, where they have those big, beautiful flowers.
Yeah.
Insects would come, get a little nectar here, a little nectar there, get a bunch of stuff on them, and then go to the next, and then they would fertilize and pollinate all these plants.
Can I maybe guess where this is going?
Yes.
This tree, the Caeunia,
yeah.
is not pollinated by insects.
That's exactly right.
Is it pollinated by birds?
Not birds.
Is it pollinated by some sort of woodland little critter?
Not a woodland critter.
Is it pollinated by the wind?
That is right. Bing, 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 bing.
And the
bing.
Air is so thin up there that it probably floats forever.
It very well may, yeah. But that's actually kind of the thing, is that it doesn't. It could,
oh,
but yeah. it does not. Don't know why. You could be right, but that's kind of another interesting thing about this. We're going to kind of get into that a little bit more. But suffice it to say, the pollen is like, this is a wind pollinated species in a family dominated by plants, and probably it has come from
oh.
a lineage of plants that has always been insect pollinated.
Okay.
So that's why its pollen is so heavy, but it has oh. been grown up there where maybe there's fewer insects or for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And its pollen is really still heavy, and its flowers are reduced to not having much at all. They don't get insects. They don't do anything. They just kind of let everything go to the wind.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Which is very curious. And it comes into our later conversation of like how these trees are growing way up where they're growing and
yeah.
why they're not growing more everywhere
yeah.
or at least further down or maybe further larger kind of forests. Right now they're just like these small little patches and zones, you know.
I have a follow-up question about wind pollination.
Yes, go.
Is wind pollination less effective overall than insect pollination?
I don't think so.
Okay.
It would be
or like lower statistics, you know.
Yeah. I don't think so. I think generally it's kind of how you go about it, where if you have a million plant or a million flowers all over the place,
mm-hmm.
they just let all of their pollen go to the wind,
okay,
then you're bound to have most of them catch something.
Okay.
But if you are, if you have fewer flowers and you put more effort into saying, I have fewer flowers, but I want each single one, every single one, to get pollinated, then insects are more effective at say, fewer, because they'll spend their entire day around a whole tree and they'll go to every single flower over the course of a day.
It's kind of curious. It reminds me of like how, is it like whales? Some species of whale just like,
yeah.
They reproduce by just basically like, sorry everyone, ejaculating into the ocean and then all the other whales just kind of like swim in it and get
kind
pregnant.
Of. I don't think that's exactly right for whales, but that,
well,
like,
of course it's not exactly right.
Yeah. It's like, well, Alex, I don't want to say no, but how can I let you down nicely? A lot of fish do what you're talking about, where they just essentially, they get into a giant, big school, and then they just go, wah, and they just let it all loose. And then everyone's just swimming through, so that's just a crapshoot of like, I hope mine goes somewhere.
What a scene, man.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. I wouldn't want to, you know, go into that and be like, hey, you guys, this is pretty dirty, you know? I feel like the fish would just be like, bro, you got to get out of here.
We call that the eye of the storm.
Nice. Well, this, I think you're right. That it's the term that I think you might be looking for is like a, what is it? It's K-reproductive and N-reproductive. Hmm. There's two different styles. Essentially, it is reproduction, where you just make millions of babies and you just let them all go. You don't take care of them. You just hope they all survive.
Yeah.
Versus having way fewer, but putting a lot of energy and effort into ensuring that one or those few survive.
And that, Casey, that's R and K.
Thank you. R and K, where R would be fewer with lots of resource allocation, and then K would be many, many, many more, but with almost no resource allocation.
I'm so sorry for the tangent, but
hey, that's okay. This is good stuff.
I've got a curiosity about me today.
That's why we call you Whiskers.
Oh, I'll take it.
Yeah. So yeah, this this tree, being a wind pollinated tree, it probably takes more of that K strategy, where it's like, go out there, good luck. I'm going to depend on this to just work, but I'm going to allocate my tree resources to other things.
Yeah.
I'm not going to put the effort to have big flowers to have, you know, all these things that make nectar and get insects to come to me. I'm just going to hope that it works.
I see.
And clearly it has, because these trees have evolved not only one species, not only in one area, but 20 or more species across the entire Andes Mountains of South America.
Wow.
From Bolivia and Chile all the way up through Argentina and Colombia.
It's very impressive.
It's very impressive. And it's always at the top of these mountains, at the highest elevation. So what you get with that is the leaves are really thick and rough. They are evergreen. They don't go away. They'll sit there. They're covered in like a nice waxy bit. They have little tiny hairs sometimes around them on the bottom to help make sure everything's warm as close as it can be. And what that does is it basically makes sure that it creates a little tiny air space. Are you familiar with the idea of like a sweater?
Yeah, I've got a few of those.
Yeah, okay. So when you have all these little hairs, and this is something that a lot of high elevation, high alpine plants will do, is they will keep their leaves small. The top will be really waxy and it'll be covered on the bottom or on the stem or however they need to with really teeny tiny little hairs.
Oh, wow.
And that basically acts like the same as, you know, hair from anything else, where it traps just a teeny amount of air really close to the leaf. That teeny amount of air stays just a micro bit warmer than the air that's just outside of it.
Interesting.
So it's just like the having your wearing a sweater. All you're doing is creating this dead air space between you and the outside.
Okay.
And that air gets warmed by your body. That warm air doesn't escape, and it kind of puts this little blanket all around you of warmer air just by smidge.
Wow. That's really cool. Is this the first tree we've talked about that does that?
Ooh.
Surely no. Doesn't Magnolia has pubescence on the bottom, but it doesn't really serve that same purpose.
No, yeah, exactly. I think this is one of the only trees that has this, because we haven't really talked about too many high alpine species, and most of the time you would see this in either drier habitats in like desert trees. Mm-hmm. Or you'd see that in this high alpine area, but most of these trees at high alpine would be either deciduous deciduous broadleaf trees, yeah. or they would be evergreen coniferous trees where they kind of take on more of a waxy coating kind of technique as opposed to these little tiny hairs. And this tree does kind of both of that. The hairs are just on the bottom. They're kind of a little bit along the stem, but they're not like a huge thing. But I would say if you're looking to try to find examples of this, look for the little tiny cushion plants are what they're called. Hmm. They're like little herbaceous plants that grow at these high elevation areas, but they look like cushions, like little blobs of plant growing in, you know, maybe in a rock crevice or something.
Yeah.
Those will have this to the T.
Okay. And is this tree deciduous?
It is not.
Okay.
Yeah. These are evergreen trees.
Wow.
And the thing is, these guys grow really high up. Like we already talked about this, but let me give you a couple numbers.
Yes, please.
The species Patua or Pauta, which would be Polylepis Pauta, P-A-U-T-A, it grows at an elevation range from 3,500 to 3,700 meters, which is essentially forever up into the sky. A meter is generally a little bit more than 3 feet. So you're multiplying all these numbers by three, and you're getting a rough general estimate of what they are.
Yeah.
And then the Polylepis sericea goes 4,200 to 42. Wow, actually, it's exactly the same. I didn't notice that when I was looking at this. Their average elevation is, the elevation range is 4,230 to 4,230.
Whoa.
So they're right there, nowhere else. But others go all the way up to 4,500 meters.
I can't even.
In the sky.
That's insane.
It's insane. It's absolutely, absolutely mind-blowing.
What is it? 4,000?
4,565. 565. Meters.
That's roughly 13,500 feet.
Yeah, which is insane. Mm. Our Mount Hood is just under 12,000 feet tall.
Wow.
So that grows higher than the peak of our highest mountain in the entire state.
That's very cool.
And that's where these trees grow. That is what creates the tree line, Alex. There's still mountain up above them. They just can't grow up there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
The Andes are fucking tall.
The Andes are huge. They're mind-blowingly huge mountains.
Yeah.
And what is interesting is that they're also in a tropical area for the most part. As you go further south, they actually become more of a temperate region than anything else. They are approaching more the southern latitudes where they are matching what we have up here.
Okay.
But what's curious is that they have a tree line, which is, they call it the natural tree line. Are you familiar with the term?
I think so. A tree line is just where the trees on a mountain stop growing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And there is, so there's a couple different terms. There's timber line, which is the spot where you stop getting like a full forest cover. Where if you're looking at a mountainside and you just see like, you know, a soft covering of forest from afar.
Yeah.
When you see it go up and all of a sudden the tree line or the timber line stops, but you still see like a speck of a tree here, tree there, tree there. Timber line is where the forest stops. Tree line is where individual trees or small groups of trees no longer grow. That's okay. That line.
Interesting. Good distinction.
Yeah, I never really gave it too much of a thought, but it is there is this difference, and this also happens as you go up to the poles or down to the poles, depending on your perspective. As you are going, the further and further north you get, you have the same kind of climactic conditions, climactic conditions that you'd get as you go way up to the top of a mountain, where essentially it gets really cold, you get a lot more snow, and you get a smaller high temperatures, lower high temperatures. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You just get a lot more cold ass days, essentially. Yeah,
the whole thing shifted down.
Yeah, exactly. So that is that's kind of the interesting thing, where if you go north or south towards the poles, you get this tree line, you get a timberline effect. Mm-hmm. As you go up to the highest elevations, you also get this timberline tree line effect. And when I started doing research for this, which I always love to happen, you know what, Alex, before we go any further, the only reason we're covering this tree is because one of our fungal associates recommended that this tree be in the Tournament of Champion Trees.
That's right. Do you have their name?
I do. We can find it in a second,
yeah,
I'm sure.
I'll find it while you talk.
So we ended up looking into, I ended up looking into this tree, and then we had to disqualify because A, there was no species that they recommended, so I couldn't say which one. And there also is, there was so little information that I could find in like a quick basis, but the trees appeared so interesting. I had to just keep on looking.
Yeah.
So that's why we're doing it now, because it's like, hey, if this isn't making the champion tournament of champion trees, at the minimum, this is going to get an entire episode so we can dive into what are they talking about? These are the highest elevation trees in the entire world.
Mm.
Whatever. Google, Google, Google. Oh my God.
And you had never, had you heard of these trees before?
I haven't, no.
Alyssa Killingsworth.
Alyssa Killingsworth, thank you.
Was the person, the fungal associate who sent us the tip off.
Yeah. So the big thing that I kind of want to discuss today is the concept of this tree line. Why do they happen, Alex, is the big question.
Mm.
What are the causes that make it so the trees can no longer colonize an area? Second thing, as I was doing research on this tree, which I knew from almost nothing, I knew the species, I knew that it grew high in the Andes, I wanted to do some, you know, do some thinking about it, figure out what it is. The big thing that I found, they're amazingly endangered trees.
Oh,
Their habitat. If you go to the Google and you look them up, you go to polylepiswikipedia.com/polylepiswikipedia.com, you will find that there's 20-some species, and several of them just don't have a page at all.
Wow.
They're the red links. They just say, this page does not exist.
Yeah.
But if you click on it, you can make this page. Then there's the blue ones. There's maybe two or three that have even a relative amount of information. And I'm pretty sure that's because they've been planted in Canada or in the Royal Botanic Gardens or something like that. So someone actually has looked at them and said, hey, well, actually, these will grow at lower elevations, just at maybe higher latitudes, and they'll do just fine. But then all the other ones, you click on the thing, and all it says is, this tree grows in the high altitudes of the Andes. It is endangered due to habitat loss. Next one, this grows in the high Andes over here. Mm. It is probably endangered because of habitat loss. So on and so on and so on and so on for almost, I think, 10 or 15 of these species.
Wow.
So I'm like, what is happening here? Why are these trees so, like, endangered? What is going on at 13,000 feet in the Andes that people are, or that the habitat's just going away? The first thing you think of is, well, maybe it's climate change, because I know down in the White Mountains of California, for example, or any of the inner mountain gigantic ranges that are also 13,000-14,000 feet high, you have a species of tree growing there that we've covered, the intermountain bristlecone pine.
Yeah.
Or the pinyon pine. Both those trees are growing there. And as climate changes and things get hotter from below, the refuge is no longer there. The trees have gone all the way up to the top of the coolest mountains.
Wow.
They cannot go any further. This is not the case for the Andean paper trees. There's still mountain above them that they could go. They are not at the tippy top peak of all the Andy Mountains.
Hmm.
So why are they not growing up? Why are they not slowly migrating up as a lot of plants are doing nowadays, as a lot of trees are doing with climate change?
Casey, we're going to explore that question. We got to take a break.
All right, all right.
We'll be right back with more Completely Arbitrary.
Hi, everybody. Or should I say, hola a todos. I want you to hear something. It's this. Yes, that is the sound of learning a new language with Babbel. You have, of course, heard of Babbel. You maybe even used Babbel. But if you haven't, Babbel is an app that helps you learn languages. Babbel is a science-backed learning language app that actually works. Let me put it this way. I knew somebody who used a different language app for 365 days and still could not even have basic conversations in the language they were learning on that app. Babbel is not this. They have quick 10-minute lessons and they're handcrafted by 200 language experts, so you can start learning a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Because it's designed by real people for real conversations. In fact, a recent study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. And of course, the best way to learn a new language is immersion. You go and live in the place where the people speak the language you're learning. You speak to the people, they speak back. But the second best way is Babbel. And it's practical. It will very quickly teach you how to order food, ask for directions, speak to shopkeepers without having to consult language apps while you're on vacation. And here is a special limited time deal for our listeners right now. Get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for Fungal Associates at babbel.com/trees. That's right. If you're listening to this, if you're a fan of this show, babbel.com/trees. Get 60% off your subscription. That's babbel.com/trees. Rules and restrictions may apply. Adios. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Hi, everybody. It's Alex here. And you know what? Come springtime, those trees are a-blooming. Those people are a-walking around. That sun is a-shining. And it makes me so grateful for my social life. People are wanting to do things again. And it can be extremely rewarding to start to see friends more often and, you know, go on cute friend dates or romantical dates, sit on a patio and drink a coffee. Ooh la la. But it's really easy to overdo it. And for me, it's very important to keep an eye on my social battery. Every time I go on a social outing, I come home and I'm like, wow, I am really tired in a very specific way. Well, that's my battery. That's my social battery being drained. And I didn't really have this language until I started going to therapy. I didn't know why being around people made me so exhausted, even though I love those people and enjoy being around them. But therapy helped me with my self-awareness and helped me unlock some language that I didn't otherwise have. And if you are struggling with feelings and thoughts that you don't understand, therapy can be a great way to unlock the power of understanding. And a great way to start is BetterHelp. It's completely online and it's designed to be super convenient and flexible, which is very important. How many times have you had a therapy session on the calendar and that time rolls around and you think, I gotta drive all the way across town. I am not gonna go. It has, of course, happened to me. I'm sure it's happened to everybody who's been in therapy. No worries with BetterHelp. It's all online. And all you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire. You get matched with a licensed therapist, of course. And nobody nails it on their first time. It's like going on dates. You gotta find the right therapist for you. It's silly to think that the very first date you ever go on is going to be your future spouse. So you can switch therapists at any time, no additional charge. It's extremely easy. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/trees today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trees. Happy spring!
Welcome back to Completely Arbitrary. Today we're talking the Andean paper tree. Polylepis is the, or lepis.
Yeah.
If you're nasty.
If you're nasty, nasty.
Is the genus?
Correct.
Okay.
Racemosa is the specific epithet, the species together being Polylepis racemosa.
Racemosa.
Yes, sir. So,
like a NASCAR brunch cocktail, a racemosa.
Yeah. The moral of the story is we're talking about a tree. We're not talking about racing nor drinking.
Yes.
The
Although we may be talking about racing in an evolutionary sense as to race away from the Earth's heating.
We could be. But, Alex, it turns out, perhaps not.
Okay.
So the big thing, I know, no, I led you there. You, I threw the ball up and you hit it like a champion hitter of balls.
I was just standing right in front of a wall.
Exactly. And I didn't tell you the wall was there.
Yeah. And it bounced back and hit me in the face.
So, well, that's the big thing. That is the big question here. Is all the research that I've been looking at, I found one article that I thought was very interesting. And I saw one guy who just kept coming back all the time. And I don't know why this person decided to do it, but his name is Michael Kessler from the University of Zurich.
Okay.
I don't know if he's still there. I haven't, I decided to just not look into him too much, just look into the tree.
Sure.
But he's written so many papers about the Andean paper tree that he's clearly one of the experts in it.
Wow.
And one of the papers he wrote was called The Polylepis Problem, Where Do We Stand? And this came out, I think, in 2002. So, and it's the polylepis problem. There's quotes to it, right?
Okay.
Because it's not like there's a problem with them. But the big problem, the reason that he calls it that is that no one can quite figure out why the polylepis tree grows where it does. Do you remember how I told you about the timber line and the tree line and all that, right?
Yes.
So there's what they call the natural tree line in the Andes, where you just have trees growing, they're growing. Okay, now there's no more trees. Keep going a little bit higher up, and then you get these bands and these groves of polylepis.
Oh, this is outside the tree line.
This is above the tree line.
Wow.
Exactly.
It's living on the frontier.
It is way out there on the frontier. It's exactly right.
Wow.
So they're like...
Interesting.
Yeah. And so many other people, Alex, over the last 100 years have said the same exact thing.
Yeah.
Like, interesting.
Huh.
Why? Why are these trees up here? What's different? And so famously in the Andes, there are... people who for millennia have lived up at these high elevation areas.
Yeah.
The quintessential example is the Inca.
Yes.
In Peru, where they live way up at elevations higher than Mount Hood in Oregon right here, than any of our other mountains. Maybe Rainier, because that's like, 14,000 feet, something like that? Anyway. More of a story is, people have been up around these trees for the longest time. So a bunch of people have said, well, here's why. These trees have been growing up here, and they're fancy trees for whatever reason. They have this, they have that. And then one guy, I think in the 1950s, Ellenberg is his name, he basically said, I think that the trees are growing the way they're growing up here beyond the natural tree line because of... human interactions over the last several million or several thousand years.
Human interactions with the paper tree?
Yes.
Okay.
Where either A, they would cut it down for fuel, or they'd cut it down because the wood's very strong. It grows really slowly, like 100 years per inch of wood.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I have to push back a little bit to some of these things. Like, there's a lot of Atlas Obscura and like travel over here and like look at these cool trees, fairy tale forests. And they're always like, these are the slowest growing trees in the world. And I'm like, whatever. You don't know what you're talking about.
Don't bristlecone pine grow extremely
slow? Yeah, exactly. And then so do any other tree that grows in these same kinds of conditions.
I see.
So any tree that grows up at the highest elevation, it could be a pinyon, it could be an oak, it could be almost any tree that can take that high elevation, really harsh habitat.
Will grow that slow.
It's going to grow that slow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just so it's happens, one of the slowest growing.
Yeah, exactly. And they also, it's depending on where it is, sometimes it doesn't even grow as a tree. And this was a question I wanted to pose to you, Alex, because I find you to be my philosophical equal in tree matters.
Wow. You, okay.
If you were
nice
to
choice.
Walk... Hey, thank you. Thanks for joining me here. My guest today is Alex Croson, a philosophical expert on trees.
Yes.
Alex, you're walking into a forest. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Now, that forest is at lower elevations, could be 120, 140 feet tall. Okay, you understand?
The trees in that forest?
Correct.
Okay.
Now, Alex, as you walk up in elevation...
Yes, Casey?
This forest gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller.
Oh.
Now, the trees, the species may change. The genus is still the same. It's Polyepis. Down here, Sericea. Over here, Seguea. Over here... Racemosa.
Okay.
Now, of course, as you get to the higher elevation, the trees become smaller and smaller and more shrub-like. However, at lower elevations, they in fact were trees.
Now, are you going to be doing this voice for the rest of the episode?
Only until the question comes, Alex.
The question is,
if you were walking in a forest, quote unquote, of trees, yet they were only 6 or 8 feet tall, would you count that as a forest? Or would you say this is a shrubland?
Oh, shrubland.
A shrubland of miniature trees, or a forest of small trees, or a forest of big shrubs. Can you call that a forest?
Here's my answer, Casey. I'm so glad you asked this question.
I knew you needed it.
Yeah.
I sent it to your people before so you could prepare.
don't tell people that.
Sorry.
I think 6 to 8 feet. I can almost see over that forest.
Yeah.
To me, I don't necessarily see that as a forest.
All right. That's fair. I would agree.
Shrubland.
Yeah, it's always kind of these things. Like, you can go to the highest elevation where bristlecone pine would grow, or a juniper.
Yeah.
And it would grow kind of in a weird shrub-like fashion.
Yeah.
Because it just gets pummeled every year by everything.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to see your opinion on that, because I think I would agree. But at the same time, I still like to go up there and I'm like, wow, look at this polylepis tree, even though it's like 4 feet tall, completely gnarled and like smashed into the side of a mountain by snow and ice and wind. I'd still be like, yeah, I'm going to give you credit. I'm gonna elevate you to tree because you're so elevated yourself.
Wow.
Sick.
Now, you may have answered this already, but is there a reason that those trees would be growing shorter at higher elevations?
Yeah, essentially, we'll take a step back and we'll talk about the biophysical environment of tree lines,
okay,
if you will. So a tree line is generally regulated by the average air temperature of that area, as well as the average soil temperature of that area.
Okay, so the colder it gets, the fewer trees you're going to find.
Exactly.
Okay.
And if the air temperature does not stay at a certain temperature for a certain period of time, then the trees essentially won't grow. And if they can't grow, they're just going to die.
Okay.
Then they're not going to get any bigger. So if a tree is growing at that just they're towing that line, then they can't get very tall because of mainly two reasons. One, they're covered in snow 99% of the year.
Mm.
When the snow finally does melt, they're just like, go! And they grow as quickly as they can, which is kind of like a slug running as fast as it can.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, great, that slug, it did it, its hour is up, it has made it 6 feet. Great, good job, slug.
And then they sleep for another 9 months.
Exactly, and they just kind of sit there and photosynthesize. So one, this paper I literally read, it's 3.1, like section 3.1, mm-hmm, biophysical elements of tree lines. It's in a paper that I found, and it is called A Review of Modern Tree Line Migration, the Factors Controlling It, and the Implications for Carbon Storage. Absolutely riveting reading, Alex.
Now, I couldn't tell if you were being sarcastic, because this sounds about on par with the sorts of things you love reading.
Yeah,
to me, at least.
It is. It's kind of on par. But it's not the most interesting thing, but it's way more interesting because it's a literature review where they don't do any of the work. They just tell all the findings of all the work.
Oh, that sounds more interesting.
Yeah, way more interesting than reading all the other things, in my opinion.
Oh, that's what a review is? It presents the findings of other research?
Yeah, a literature review, essentially.
Okay.
Where they're like, if you're doing research, a literature review is a great spot because, A, they've done all the review for you. They say, hey, here is the state of the science right now. Here's all we got on this one subject.
That's cool.
At least if it's a good literature review, they really dive into every single possibility of what could be considered in that review.
Are those released like annually?
Oh, no. This would be a scientific paper in and of itself. So it'd be like,
okay,
you're a bona fide scientist. You've done all your papers and you're like, man, I'm tired of like looking everywhere for everything. I'm going to spend my next year and a half compiling all of this and then putting it out there. But you as the expert have to know the material well enough to read through it and then take the findings and compare them and contrast them and say, here's, you know, generally we think this, but this paper dissents and then this paper dissents, but then all of these papers provide this evidence for that. So ultimately it's likely that this is here, you know?
Hmm.
So it's not like it comes out like, hey, here's an annual review. It's more like, when some scientist finds that there's a need for this, they will go and do this paper.
I see.
So this is essentially was written because they're like, hey, in modern day, the world, we are dealing with climate change, and people are saying here and there that different tree lines are migrating either up to higher elevations or further north, or further south.
Okay.
So essentially the tundra is becoming a treed space instead of just, you know, flat land with only shrubs and herbs and things like that.
Yeah.
So if everyone's saying that, basically they wrote this paper to say, hey, here, it looks like this is happening. There are all these papers documenting this across the entire world, and here's what's going on. So they talk in this results and discussion section basically what the findings are that people say are keeping trees from growing up higher. And the big thing they note is that tree growth requires a minimum growing season length of at least 94 days, as defined by all days having an average daily temperature of greater than 9 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
So, 9 degrees Celsius, I'm sorry, 0.9 degrees Celsius is like just above freezing.
Okay. Yeah,
just right above freezing.
Yeah.
So, that is basically them saying this tree, in order for trees to grow, you have to have more than freezing or warmer temperatures than freezing for at least 94 days.
Okay. 94 consecutive days.
It doesn't say consecutive. It says at least 94 days. So, I would bet that it would be early in spring, you get one day, and then maybe 3 days or below that. But then after that, you start getting 2 or 3 days in a row. Then there's maybe one day below it. Then there's more. So once it kind of becomes aggregate, you probably get more in the middle. That's going to be consecutive days. And then on either end of that time frame, you're going to get days that are kind of interspersed.
I got you.
Of the growing season.
Okay.
So anyway, the big thing that they talk about is that it depends on where you are in the world, how high your mountains are, and how much water you have. And this is the thing that I thought was really, really interesting, is that they list a bunch of different things. Average temperature is one of them that influences tree line position, but the other thing is the timing of the growing season. Other things include the factors such as is there adequate snow protection on the tree? So basically, if it's covered in snow during wintertime, it doesn't get blasted by ice when winds come through. It's also somewhat protected by desiccating winds that come over and just rip all the moisture out of a leaf.
Although it's also not photosynthesizing during that period,
exactly.
Right?
But it would be too cold anyway. So if it's, it's below freezing.
Oh, it needs warmth. Oh, the growth period is when it starts photosynthesizing.
Yes, exactly. So in the dormant period, if it's covered in snow, it's like insulated. It's like, I'm so warm and toasty down here. This is so lovely.
And it doesn't need to photosynthesize during those periods.
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. The rest of this list is huge. It says insufficient effective temperature sum and length of growing season, lack of precipitation, competition, incoming solar radiation, and the permafrost depth of the active soil layer, extreme soil temperatures, moisture availability, fires, frost occurring during the growing season, high wind speeds, a bunch of stuff. Like,
so these are all the conditions that are needed for it to grow.
Yes. And it's either it's the thing that has an influence on it. So let's take Oregon here, for instance. We have tree lines at all the high mountains that we have. And what mostly is causing that is that as you go higher and higher, you get temperatures that are lower and lower for longer periods of time. So first off, a tree seedling, let's say seed lands there, starts to grow in this nice little cubby. As it comes out, if there's not enough warm temperatures for that plant to actually grow and significantly put roots on and get taller, then sometimes it'll just be covered in snow the whole year round. It'll never photosynthesize and it will die. Mm. It could get past that and start growing up above where the snow melts, but then the winds will come through and completely desiccate it, and it won't have enough water in that area because it drains out too quickly, or it's too rocky, so there's no water there to begin with other than right when the snow is melting. But then you also get, it's just too moving, like the whole soils are not stable, so landslides come through all the time, or like the rocks are slowly moving, or they're too big so you can't like find your way down to where there is sunlight because the rocks you fall in like this giant crevice, you know. So there's all these like weird different things that happen. But then in Mount Katahdin in Maine, it's where the ATC, AT, the Appalachian Trail ends. You walk all the way up and you go to that last mountain in Maine. Apparently, it has never registered a temperature above 70 degrees at the top of that mountain.
Oh, wow.
Not a single time. And that is like, that's why there's a tree line there. It's way too cold, way too often.
Yeah.
So no trees grew up there, but the top of it is like 5,000 feet, 6,000 feet, like it's super low. We have trees on Mount Hood that grow all the way up to like 7,000 feet. The bristlecones in California grow at 11,000 or 12,000 feet, 13,000 feet, and right here we're dealing with trees that grow at 16,000 feet in the Andes.
So that mountain in Maine is just colder,
yeah,
than our mountain here.
Essentially,
so it has
yeah.
a lower tree line.
The tree line is just a little bit lower.
Okay.
So all these different things come together and they affect where tree lines are. So in certain places in like Scotland, it's like 1,000 feet or something like that. Mm. Like it's really low, but they're high in latitude.
Oh, right.
So anyway.
Okay.
It's very complicated, right?
Yeah. It's like all these little, it's like a little abacus, like all these yeah. little numbers sliding back and forth.
Just constantly moving it around.
Yeah.
But apparently the big one essentially is how much water do you have sure. and how hot it is it?
Okay.
So in the Andes, they actually have, so it's in the southern hemisphere. So here, the south side of a hill or a slope gets more direct sunlight than the north side
mm.
because the sun comes at it at a little bit of an angle.
Okay.
So if you picture the earth, the equator, the sun is hitting it directly.
Yeah.
But then as you go further and further north, the light actually is shining at a certain angle that hits the southern slopes more directly. And if you're in the southern hemisphere, it's the exact opposite.
Okay.
So in that exact opposite way, on the north slopes in the south, it's just a little bit warmer. Because it's a little bit warmer, you find more polylepis trees on mm. the north slopes in the Andes because the temperatures are just a little bit higher. So you get a little bit longer growing season and the trees can get a little bit taller and actually get a good foothold.
So the
right?
tree line will kind of change depending on where on the mountain you are.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And so polylepis grows in like ravines and like little rocky places that are a little bit more condensed and kind of shaded from all these, not shaded, but protected from these different elements. And so people were like, well, okay, so we can figure this out. And if you're trying to figure out where a polylepis grows, they generally will always grow on like these very specific spots, like above 4,000 feet, but less than, or 4,000 meters, but less than 4,200 meters in like the humid eastern side of the Andes. But then over 5,000 meters on more arid volcanoes in the Cordillera area or on different mountain slopes. So you end up finding like these specific changes in certain species grow in certain areas, whether that's north or south, like along the gradient of the whole Andes Mountains,
yeah.
which for those of you who don't know, they essentially run the entire spine of South America. And so these trees will grow up there, but they're so disjunct in where they are and they're above this natural tree line where this old guy, Ellensberg was like, this doesn't make any sense. If we take all of the different ideas and all these different factors, this abacus that you just described, and we put them together, the math comes out that there should be more of these trees everywhere where there's a bunch of places that they're not growing.
So that is the big question.
That is the big
Why
question.
Why aren't they growing where they should be?
Exactly. And
or where they could be.
Precisely. And what this guy came up with is he basically said, honestly, it's people. People have been here for such a long period of time.
Yeah.
They've either been cutting it for fuel wood. They've been cutting it to make, actually in the 1800s, mine shafts, like holding up a mine so it doesn't collapse on
wow.
you.
Wow.
But also, they would have animals come up and graze over there, the famous for alpacas and different animals mm-hmm. like that. So these forests apparently have been getting decimated. They'd also light fires, and those fires would kill all these trees, but it would keep open habitat for game animals.
And because the trees grow so slowly, it's not like the next year they'll put on a new roots, new shoots, and reforest themselves.
Yeah, exactly. And
okay.
But apparently, people went insane. They're like, you're crazy, man. There's no way people could do this. There's no way that this kind of continent-wide differences in where these trees are growing is because of people. And then they ripped him apart. A bunch of criticism. But as it turns out, the evidence supports this idea.
Yeah.
Because if they were right, all the people who are critiquing Ellensberg, then there would be trees everywhere because there are not trees everywhere. And because people have been interacting with these ecosystems for millions or thousands of years. I always want to say millions of years because I think in tree terms and I realize, you know, humans have not been there that long, probably only about 20,000 years.
You have to convert tree years to human years.
This is very difficult for me. I really have a hard time with it.
Where do dog years fit in?
Oh, geez. I can't do that kind of compound math. It's just too much. But yeah, so it's kind of an interesting thing where people have been interacting with this for so long in such certain ways,
yeah.
whether that be directly cutting the trees down or indirectly lighting fires to keep the habitat better for them, or just having fires that work better for the things that they wanted, say maize planting or for growing any other kind of crop. Potatoes, famously, are from this area, wild potatoes. Mm. So it's just one of those things that I never quite thought about, and I'm sure that we here in the United States, the Western United States, and everywhere else in the world where there are these kinds of tree lines, it is a hugely environmentally affected place.
Mm.
But people, especially if people live up at those high elevation areas, just like in Tibet, where you have people that live at these high elevations affecting different things and having animals and crops at these high elevations, they certainly have probably had an effect on as to where this tree line is.
Right.
And that to me is so fascinating, because we always give like birds an example. We've talked about the Clark's Nutcracker,
yeah,
with the whitebark pine as well as the bristlecone pine. They affect where that tree grows because they plant the seed in different places. Whereas people may affect where trees go because we light fires and that will move them around and cause these disjunct populations, which I always found like so fascinating, where this is like, what? We affected the entire distribution of a species of tree. Now, because we've cut so many down, a bunch of these forests are endangered. The trees are under threat. And of course, people are planting them back, which is really nice.
So, Casey, what do you think about, you know, you and I have opinions on like corporations, like clear cutting for timber and lumber is what I meant to say.
Limber and tumber.
But the Andean paper tree is not necessarily being affected by corporations. It's,
yeah,
it's being affected by indigenous people.
Uh-huh.
So what is your take on, is that a positive or a, yeah, negative or a neutrality, oof, for you?
You know, what it says to me is one thing. First off, in a realist sense, there is this romantic notion of indigenous people being like this, these stewards of the land, and they have all of these like high-minded ideals of taking care of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not true. And I don't mean to take it away from their experience, because they, more than anyone else, have lived within their ecosystem.
Yeah.
But anything that lives within an ecosystem has an effect
of
on
course,
that ecosystem.
Yeah.
So that effect, at some point, probably before mines were built in the Andes, that was probably in pretty good balance, where these people that lived up there had to migrate. They couldn't live up there all the time. So they would migrate down to lower elevations when it got too cold, then move back up.
I see.
So there is at least a balance is what I would assume would exist, where these ecosystems were treated the same for so long that they balanced themselves out into a certain situation. And that's kind of the big difference. The indigenous uses of things were specific, and they were done in a way that was as best as they could. Their technology perhaps wasn't, you know, they didn't have the chainsaw, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They didn't have metal to begin with to try and do these kinds of huge cuts. So in that case, it's like, yeah, great. That's actually, that seems like a nice use. You have a resource, you're definitely going to use it. But then when you bring in kind of the economies of the colonizing world, then that gets pushed to overdrive. I'm reading a book right now called The Golden Spruce. The indigenous people cut down and killed a bunch of species of animals and plants because they're like, yeah, well, we'll make a bunch of money on this. And if they didn't do it, someone else was going to do it. So
right,
you get this weird system. I don't know, Alex. It's very complicated. But I would say, you know, trying to tamp down that idea of sort of the romantic kind of idealization of this perfect unity, you know, an avatar-like world, then if I kind of push that away, then I say, no, they were using it in a way that at least was imbalanced, because if they didn't, they would have perished as well.
Sure.
Because they would have, the resource would have been used up.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I don't know.
All right. And there you have it, the hot take from Alex.
That is most of my opinions.
Yeah. Well,
I'm still processing it. I'm still absorbing. I honestly can't make a statement that soon after learning information.
Gotcha.
I don't know.
Well, the thing that I thought about is here in the Willamette Valley, for instance,
yeah.
It has famously had fires burned through it by the native peoples here before the colonists came.
Yeah.
Because that was how they, kept down things like poison oak. Less poison oak was there. They kept it open for the plants that they would eat. Camas bulbs is a great example. And they would keep it open for their game animals to use this big, wide, open prairie kind of space.
And it benefited the trees, too, right?
It did. The oak tree was, like, dominant in this area because there was nothing else to compete with it.
Yeah.
But then my thought is, if they did not start these fires, if for whatever reason no people came into the Willamette Valley to begin with, it just didn't happen, would we not be seeing a like ponderosa pine forest move down and cover the entire valley with these big tall trees that can take the same conditions? Maybe fire comes through every now and then, put on by lightning or something else. Would we actually be looking at an ecosystem that's completely different? And we're now idealizing this oak ecosystem because that's what used to be there with these other people. They all lived in balance, but there was fire in the ecosystem that was lit by mostly the native peoples in the area.
Yeah.
If they weren't there and there were no fires, the ecosystem is different. We'd still idealize that old ecosystem, most likely. So it's a weird kind of like, what is it? It's a counterfactual, I think is what it is. And you think like, well, what would happen if this didn't happen? You like think through that kind of scenario.
Right.
So I don't know. It makes me wonder if if we think back to what we talked about last week, where humans are not a part of nature, where it's not just a human affected nature, therefore it's changed, therefore it's bad or it's different or whatever it is, then it's all good. Like we just have to look at it as like we are still another impact, another thing affecting the system. And the system is just evolving again, just as it always does. So in that case, I don't think it's bad. I think it's maybe bad that the impact has become way more intense over the last 200 to 300 years.
Yeah.
That could be a bad thing if you're trying to say, yeah, I kind of like the way it was. But in the scheme of we're all a part of this, like it's all we are one thing, then it's bad that we're using our technology to destroy it. And not giving the polylepis tree the right to live just because it is a thing that lives. You know what I mean?
But that all the only, I mean, all of this, like the imbalance started post Spanish, right?
Most likely, yeah.
Okay. So I guess we can just, it's very easy to blame colonization.
It is. Yeah. So maybe we'll just do it there and call it good. But one thing before we go, before talking about just the human things that these forests interacted with, they also interacted with what I called a support crew of animals. Not support crew. They supported a crew of animals.
Oh, wow.
And I just have to read them because as I was reading through this list, it became a little bit more like exotic in a really fun way. So I'll start with the Andean condor, which is very similar to the California condor, like a gigantic bird that is more or less a vulture kind of thing.
Isn't that the bird with the biggest wingspan?
I think so. Yeah, it's either that or the wandering albatross. One of the two are gigantic like that. But then there's the Cochabamba mountain finch, which I thought was beautiful. Ooh. The royal Cynclodes, Cynclodes, uh-huh, which is another little bird. But then there's the black-breasted puffleg.
Is that a bird?
That's a bird, I think. I can't imagine what I want to know. I did want to look them up because I just like the idea of thinking of a puffleg. But then there's the red-tailed comet, which is pretty cool. The ash-breasted tit tyrant. It's a tit tyrant.
Wow.
What is a tit tyrant? It's like there's a dash. So it makes me think that the tyrant is being modified by the tit. So it's a tyrant that's tit-like. It's a tit tyrant.
Who's going to say it is a tyrant to the tits?
Yeah, I assume so. Then there's the marbled four-eyed frog, which sounds pretty cool.
Wow.
But I assume it just wears glasses, and that's pretty derogatory. The Andean mountain cat. And then the spectacled bear, Casey. The spectacled bear, it gets the more proper name for wearing glasses. So what's the difference? Why are they being so mean to the frog and not the bear?
By the way, this four-eyed frog, you gotta look it up.
Okay,
it has a a little, what looked like a little pair of eyes on its like hips.
Oh, okay. All right.
Its rump.
Well, the last leg or the last one that I'm really glad they left to the end, it's a screaming hairy armadillo.
Oh my God.
So I'm reading through this. I'm like, man, we really need these forests to stick around. The cast of characters.
I need to go to an Andean petting zoo. This sounds incredible.
Yeah. Hi, welcome to Screaming Hairy Armadillo's viewing area.
You have to wear earplugs in that segment.
Yeah, exactly. Put on big things.
Casey, I think it's a great time for our review of the Andean paper tree. Here's how it goes. We're going to give it some final thoughts on this tree and then give it a rating of 0 to 10 golden cones of honor as our resident...
Screaming armadillo.
Yeah, as our resident screaming armadillo, we'll begin with you.
Oh, man. I just want to hear what they're like. Like, what if you spook one, you know? Like, that's really what I want to know. Oh, Jesus, there's a screaming armadillo over there.
Oh, I love goats that scream.
Yeah, I saw when I first looked up screaming, the goat came up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I decided to look for this.
It's a real horrendous sound.
I'm sure it is. I hope you never run into a horde of them, like that meet each other and they try to communicate. Yeah. It's just a screaming goat yelling at a screaming armadillo.
That's so freaky.
That's so metal, man.
Makes me think of Black Phillip.
Whatever that means, Alex.
It's from The Witch. That's a horror movie a few years ago. They have a goat and they named it Black Phillip. It's a black goat.
Oh, okay.
And it
yeah.
is the devil incarnate.
Oh.
It's a great movie, Casey.
I like this. Anyway. Black Phillip. Wow, that is a rump of a frog.
Yeah, man.
Honestly, 10 out of 10 golden cones of honor for the four-eyed frog. You know what? I'm going to call it the spectacled frog.
Hey,
because
there
I think
you go.
That's a more proper term. But anyway, sorry. Let's get back to it. We're talking about...
Someday we will raise enough money to get this frog contact lenses.
We really will. But until then, we're just going to have to let it, you know, look you right in both eyes at the same time. Oh, right. We're talking about the Polylepis, Racemosa, the tree that is otherwise known as the Andean paper tree. I think that it's just a spectacular tree.
Yeah.
The big thing that I think is really fascinating about it is that it grows at like wildly high amount of like heights, 14.3 meters, 15.9 meters at like really high elevations, like at well over 4,000 feet, you're still going to get a tree that it's like 50 feet tall.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me. Like, I just am stunned by that. And they're apparently some of the strongest trees. This is it's got to be a superlative tree for being the highest elevation, or the tree, the broadleaf tree that grows at the highest elevation.
Yeah.
The only thing that beats it is apparently the Tibetan juniper.
Oh, wow.
It's the only tree that grows higher than this, which I thought was really cool. And that one is like mind-blowingly small as well. Like, it should barely count as a tree. But, you know, I think I'm gonna say that I'm gonna count it as a tree, even though
of
it's
course.
A very, very small tree at the highest elevations, because they're like the crumults forms, where they're like literally laying on the mountainside, being like, "Wind, go away!
Oh my
Just
God.
Go right over me!"
Still a tree.
So I'm gonna give the Andean paper tree all of them because I think they can all kind of count. I had to pick one species,
sure,
but they all kind of just grow in different ways and different elevations as you go north and south along the mountain range.
Yeah,
I'm gonna give it like an 8.2.
Wow, very nice.
It's a beautiful tree, and they grow in such a wild, amazing place, and they host a screaming armadillo.
Yeah.
And a puffleg. How can you fault a tree for doing that?
I can't, Casey. 8.2 golden cones of honor.
Yeah.
For the Andean paper tree from Casey Clapp.
Well, Alex, what do you think here? This is a big conversation. There's a lot going on here.
Yeah. I think it's a great tree. I think it's a great looking tree.
Yeah.
I always respect a tree that has a high number of why would you grow there-ness?
Yeah.
Why would you live there-ness?
Yeah. Do you think it gets a lot of sleep with the armadillos around?
No. Yeah, I think it's probably evolved to not have ears.
Oh, how interesting.
Sense vibration.
I see. It's just a deaf tree with a huge smile on its face.
Finally, I rest.
It took me millions of years, but I can't hear a damn thing.
Oh, God. Yeah, I love its what it has going on with the wildlife around there.
Mm-hmm.
which we didn't do a Croson's Homegrown Trivia, but I now am kind of kicking myself and wishing I had.
Okay.
Because it's maybe we'll do a little bonus something. Ooh, here or there.
Ooh, yeah, okay.
It is, you know, I think like a paper bark maple,
yeah,
is like kind of cool.
Yeah, okay.
This takes that to a completely different level.
Good point.
This is the ultimate paper bark.
Yeah.
This is like the grandfather of the grandfather of the paper bark.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Okay. I'm feeling an 8.1.
Ooh, this is a close. We almost got the same there.
Yeah. That's where I'm landing with this thing. I think it's a really cool tree. I would of course love to see them someday.
Yeah.
But it's very unlikely. I've always wanted to hike to Machu Picchu.
Oh yeah.
I'm assuming they grow around there.
They do specifically. Yeah. Yes.
So
and higher up, in fact.
And that would be a nice bonus. I get to see some ruins and I get to see the Indian paper tree.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe someday I will see it. And I give it an 8.1.
Hey, 8.1. That's a pretty good score.
Yeah. Not well, very, very well deserved.
Yeah. Towards our friend, Ms. Killingsworth.
Yes.
Thank you for sending us this tree. Now that we've had the time to actually send it in and we've chosen a species, how do you think it would do on the Tournament of Champion Trees?
I honestly think it would have killed.
Yeah, I think it would have.
Casey, that was our review of the Indian paper tree. It's time for our completely arbitrary Q&A. This week's question is from Gillian. Gillian asks, my father and I have a few questions about ash trees.
Ooh.
We have a few questions here. Well, we're gonna try to consolidate into one mega question.
All right. You're just going to ask it entirely?
I'm going to read verbatim
what
Gillian says here. Considering the fact that the population has been greatly harmed by the emerald ash borer, we were wondering what regular people like us could do about it.
Ugh.
Do you think that planting more of the trees would be wise, or would that simply encourage the population of the beetle?
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I'll ask you, Casey.
Alex, this is a very timely question.
How so? Oh, are emerald ash borers up?
They are up.
Stock is up.
Stock is up. If you want to bet against ash trees, now's the time.
Yeah, bummer.
So our old friend loves tamaracks. is a green industry worker, I think, at the minimum, up in Quebec. Last time we talked, it turns out the reason that loves tamaracks, Alex, like basically went off social media, was that they were destroying dead ash trees that had been completely decimated by the emerald ash borer.
They went off to fight the war.
Yeah, but then also were scarred by it and was like, wow, you kill so many ash trees and you realize this is pretty bad.
Oh, God.
Places like Chicago had a bunch of trees growing, and those were elm trees. Dutch elm disease came through. All trees died. They said, well, what are we going to plant? Well, we got a bunch of ash trees. Let's plant a bunch of ash trees. Oh. Perfect. All those ash trees grow up, and then boom, they all die. And there's photos you can go find on the internet of a beautiful road, day one, no ash, or no ash borer. Gorgeous canopy. You go back a few days later, or a few years later, and every single tree is just completely just dead. And it just looks like horrendous. It's terrifying.
Yeah. So are there any like person to person things that you and I can do as not, well, you're an industry professional, but I'm not. I guess I sort of am.
Yeah, I think you are. You made it there. Congratulations.
The average person can do to prevent or help the cause against emerald ash borer.
Yes. And that is, don't move firewood around.
Oh, right.
If you know what kind of species of tree it is, if it's kiln dried, you buy it at some place, not, you know, Joe on the side of the road says firewood here, buy it.
Yeah.
If you are going and buying firewood, kiln dried, and it is, you know, essentially certified bug free, feel free. Kiln dry just means that they dry it to a certain dryness level.
Yeah.
And that will generally kill all of the insects and grubs that are inside of it. In a kiln, yeah. So in this way, if you don't do that, then the insect bores in and then it lays its eggs. Then those eggs will then hatch and become little grubs that'll eat inside the tree and girdle it, just like a bark beetle. Mm. It is essentially a bark beetle. And that will then, A, kill the tree, but then the grubs will overwinter inside the tree. Then the next year, they will pop out with these D-shaped holes and then they will fly away. So if you cut that tree down when it's dying, you're like, oh, my tree's dying. dying. Cool, I'm just going to cut it down, chop it all up, take it over to your neighbor's house. They drive it to their neighbor's house. They tell their friend, oh, yeah, take it with you as you go across the Rocky Mountains and you're going to go camp in Oregon. Let's say maybe around Forest Grove. They take their logs over there. They set them out there. They say, oh, I actually don't need them. I'm just going to set them on the side of my my house. Then all those insects, once springtime comes and starts getting warmed up, they're like, hey, cool, it's time to go. They eat out of that wood, and then they go disperse. And that is exactly what happened for the first time this summer, this spring. They found emerald ash borer in Oregon at Forest Grove, which is the first time they found it, I believe, west of the Rocky Mountains.
So somebody brought it over
their
firewood.
Yeah, most likely. That's the most likely situation.
Wow.
So you can do that. The other thing you can do is pay attention to your ash trees. Ash trees, for those of you who don't know, have bark that is very cross-hatched. It looks like a bunch of X's all the way around it. They're oppositely arranged with pinnately compound leaves, and they have these long single samara seeds that come down on the seed bearing trees. They are dioecious. So if you see a tree that is dying back, and from where it dies back, it has a bunch of like weird sprouts coming out that look really unhealthy, those are trees that probably have the emerald ash borer in it. Look for little D-shaped exit holes from those trees to see if the insect has already left. You'd see those right now if it is a tree that's half dying.
D-shaped.
Yeah. Because they as they crawl out, the top of them is a little bit curved and their bottom is very flat. So when they chew out, they have that D-shaped thing.
Creepy.
Yeah. It is. It's the worst. And they will kill ash trees 99%. Like straight up. They'll kill almost every single tree that they find. And that of course is a huge problem. We have Oregon ash here. We also have plenty of different species of ash trees growing in our urban areas, and we've been waiting for this to come. There's no reason it shouldn't have already been here, except apparently we had this moratorium on moving firewood, and then the Biden administration or whoever underneath the Biden administration, I think last year, the year before, basically just said, hey, we don't need to worry about this moratorium anymore. And they took it off. And then lo and behold, 2 years later, now we got it.
Almost immediately.
Ugh, it's so sad. This is one of the things that's taken a long time to like sink in. And every time I pass an ash tree now, I'm just like, your time is severely limited.
Wow.
It's truly sad. And it's one of those things where you know how like people can be a little bit outrageous about things? Not outrageous. What am I thinking? Sensational.
Yeah.
This, the reality matches up to the sensationalistness of it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So 99% of all the ash trees are probably going to die within, you know, the next couple of years. They found this tree first in Detroit in 2002, to put that all in perspective. Took 20 years for the whole continent to essentially get got
Holy
by this species,
shit.
Which is like a half an inch long and like a quarter of an inch wide.
Prolific little guys.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what you can do, Alex. Don't move firewood. Report it. If you see an ash that's struggling and you can see that there's something going wrong with it, report it to your local extension service or report it to your local invasive species organization. We'll put a – Oregon has one. We'll put a link in this episode.
Great.
Oh, man.
Well, anyway. With that, thank you, Gillian, for your question.
Yeah.
If you have a question about trees, maybe a less depressing one, email us at arbitrarypod@gmail.com. It's ARBORTRARY pod. Or join us on Instagram at arbitrarypod. And if you want to support this podcast, join the Patreon, patreon.com/arbitrarypod. Join the Arboretum for 2 bonus episodes a month, or the Cone of the Month Club for unique die cut cone sticker illustrated by an independent artist every single month. Casey Clapp.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for this tale of this Andean paper tree.
Yes, you are welcome. Thanks for listening and having good perspectives.
Well, it's my pleasure. My perspective of, I don't know.
Yeah, that, and you helped us decide what exactly a high alpine shrubland forest counts as.
That's right. So those are shrublands.
Yeah, I think that counts. I think that's
Or is it shrubland like Dublin?
Ooh, I think it's shrublands.
Okay.
So I don't think we can quite go like shrubland. But honestly, it'd be kind of fun. No, maybe if we go up there and live for a while, we can call ourselves Shrubliners.
In this podcast, we make our own reality.
That's exactly right, Alex.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Completely Arbitrary. We will see you next time. Goodbye.
Au revoir. Completely Arbitrary is produced by Alex Croson and Casey Clapp.
Our artwork is by Jillian Barthold, and our music is by Aves and the Mini Vandals.
And you can support the podcast at patreon.com/arbitrarypod.
And find additional readings at completelyarbitrary.com. Thanks for listening.